The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Again, it's a pleasure to welcome you here. I'm Laurent Levy. I'm a budding anthropologist and host of the global phenomenon known as the Other Animals podcast, available wherever fine podcasts are found. The opening of an ancient sitcom, American sitcom, featured a middle-aged couple crooning about the good old days when, among other notable bygone staples of life, goyles were goyles and men were men. And yet, like most of those pleas for some vague former better times, when things were imagined to be simpler and purer, gender really never has been. We surely like to imagine that it has been, that our gender and sexuality are bedrocks upon which our entire civilization and culture has been built. Our gender and sexuality provide us the foundation of who we are, after all. And from there, we can potentially branch out and form our own identities. But at least we have that starting point. And if that notion ever got challenged, well, we need look no further than our fellow planetary procreators, the non-human animals. For the animals all up and down the taxonomic scale, surely goyles are goyles and men are men. No silly cultural cues or social constructs to muddy the biological waters here. A fruit fly is a fruit fly only because of its strong attraction to fruit, after all. Well, tonight our speaker is about to shatter that little cocoon of imagined normalcy in a way that only he can. Dr. Franz De Waal is the author of The Bonobo and the Atheist, an exploration of the biological roots of human morality found in primate social interaction. His other 16 books include Mama's Last Hug, Animal Emotions and What They Tell Us About Ourselves, Are We Smart Enough to Know How Smart Animals Are, and The Age of Empathy, Nature's Lessons for a Kinder Society. Dr. De Waal is a member of the National Academy of Sciences and the Royal Dutch Academy of Sciences, the C.H. Candler Professor in Emory University Psychology Department, and the former director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center. His most recent book is entitled Different, Gender Through the Eyes of a Primatologist. Based on the decades of human and animal research, Different argues that biology doesn't necessarily support traditional gender roles in human communities. Different is a fresh and thought-provoking approach to the long-running debate about the balance between nature and nurture and where sex and gender roles fit in. Dr. De Waal peppers his discussion with details from his own life, a Dutch childhood in a family of six boys, his marriage to a French woman with a different orientation towards gender, and decades of academic turf wars over outdated scientific theories that have proven hard to dislodge from public discourse. He discusses sexual orientation, gender identity, and the limitations of the gender binary, exceptions to which are also found in other primates. Ladies and gentlemen, guys and goyles, and non-binary piles, I present to you Dr. Franz De Waal.
Thank you. Yeah, I think what we have learned during the COVID crisis is that we are primates because people have been very unhappy with all these digital meetings and Zoom meetings. And I think we want to feel people, we want to smell people, we want to see them up close. And this whole idea that we can replace that with digital contact, I think, is now out of the window. So I selected this topic because I thought, why not pick something uncontroversial that everyone agrees on? And so I ended up picking this. But you know, the real reason is that each time I talk about sex differences in the primates, I talk a lot about social behavior, like differences in violence or differences in empathy or bonding. People are very curious about it. I think there's a great curiosity about the biology of gender. And even though there are people who say gender is totally separate from biology, gender is a purely cultural construct, I don't think everyone believes that, and there remains curiosity because the two things remain connected, and I'll explain what I mean by that. So let me first start with explaining sex and gender and how we look at that. So sex is usually, biological sex, we usually talk about the biological differences such as the genitals, the chromosomes, the hormones, also the size difference, which is called sexual dimorphism. Actually, the biggest difference, because the size difference in humans is fairly small between males and females, the biggest difference is in physical strengths. The physical strengths of men exceeds that of women to a degree that there's barely any overlap. So even the best trained female athletes, Olympic athletes, they only reach the average level of untrained man. So that's how big that difference is. So there's a big strength difference, and of course other secondary characteristics and so on, and that's the biological sex. And then gender. Gender has to do with expectations. So for example, this guy, he expects to be taller than a woman, which and that's why he's standing up. So it has to do with expectations, cultural norms, your education, what you learn, what people tell you, how you have to behave as a man, how you have to behave as a woman. And so it's a cultural construct. But it always remains connected. It's a bit like that discussion between nature and nurture. You can never tease them apart, and the media, they will try that. The media will tell you this characteristic is 90% genetic. But you really cannot make a statement like that. That's a nonsense statement. These things are always completely intertwined. And so even though we treat gender often as a separate construct, it is never completely separate. And then in addition, we have in the English language the confusion, and that's why gender is now overused as a term. We have the confusion that the word sex is used in two ways, like you can have sex or you have a sex. And so we have two meanings for the word sex, and as a result, people have started using word gender to replace the word having a sex. And so they will say, what's the gender of your dog? Now, the dog doesn't really necessarily have a gender, but that's what people will say. So it is overused at the moment, the term. In our case, the size difference is not so great compared to many other primates. In many other primates, the sexual dimorphism is greater. I wanted to show a picture of my family. This is my mom with her six sons, which is also sexual dimorphism right here. And maybe my curiosity about gender came also about because I'm from a family like that, and I basically grew up among men and boys because I also went to a boys' school for a long time, and it's only at college level that I met a lot of girls. So the comparison I want to make is with the apes. So that's a very important distinction to make in primatology, is we have apes and monkeys. Monkeys have tails. The apes, we are all apes. We are large, tailless primates. We're also intelligent, very intelligent compared to the monkeys. And so the apes, and among the apes, my main comparison is with bonobos and chimpanzees. And so I make this triangular comparison. Bonobos and chimps are also, you saw the other two, which are gorillas and orangutans, they are also apes, but we have a huge difference between male and female, which is smaller in chimps and bonobos. So if you look at the size difference in chimps and bonobos, it's a bit bigger than in our species, but not so much. The biggest here is the chimpanzee. The chimpanzee male is really built like a bodybuilder with an enormous amount of muscles and a big neck and so on. And the male chimpanzee dominates the females. Every healthy male chimpanzee dominates the females. In the bonobo, it's actually the opposite. In the bonobo, the females dominate. And like, I'll explain how that works. That's a collective dominance by the females. And so it's very interesting that we have two close relatives who are exactly equally close to us, but who have such different behavior. And people are used to a comparison with chimpanzees. The anthropologists always favor the chimpanzee. They don't know what to do with the bonobo. The bonobo is too peaceful and too sexy and too female-dominated. The anthropologists have after all, built a whole theory of how we became humans by being aggressive and violent, and so they are sort of embarrassed by the bonobo, I think. I cannot help them with that. You know, the bonobo is exactly equally close to us, and so is exactly equally relevant to the discussion. And so we need to bring the bonobo in to this discussion. And for a gender discussion, it's really interesting to have them. So I do speak of genders in the ape. So people often say that, you know, animals have sexes and only humans have genders. I don't agree with that, because if gender is culturally constructed, is based on what you learn during your lifetime of how to behave, I think that applies to other primates as well. So if you look at human development, we consider ourselves usually adult when we are 18 or 20. So we're very slow developing animals. But from the perspective of evolution, that's a bit puzzling, because evolution actually likes fast reproduction. Like, you know, fruit flies or rabbits. That's what we like in biology, fast reproduction. And if we slow it down, as we do for elephants and whales and humans and apes, when it is slowed down tremendously, there must be a reason. There must be a good reason to do so. And the reason is that we need to learn a lot before we are competent adults. And that same reason applies to the apes. So the apes we consider adult when they're 16. Fully grown when they're 16. The nursing period in apes is actually longer than in humans. They remain small for a very, very long time and dependent on their mom for about 10 years. They travel with their mom for a long time. And so they have a very slow development too. And in their case too, it is because they need to learn a lot of things before they can be competent adults. And that includes learning about your gender. That includes learning how to behave as a male or how to behave as a female. And so I think the concept of gender can be applied to them as well. This is the nursing of bonobos and chimpanzees is 4 to 5 years, so that's a very long time. And you know, the weaning is at the age of 4. I know in humans, for example, we always speak of the terrible 2s, which is the human weaning age. The bonobos and chimps, they have the terrible 4s, because they go through tantrums and they protest and they don't want to stop nursing. So we speak of culture in the primates because there's a lot of transmission of knowledge, and I think this applies also to sex-typical behavior. To give an example, this is a study that was done on termite fishing by female chimpanzees. So they have certain techniques of how they extract the termites from the hills and which tools and how long the tools are and so on. And I'm not going to explain these graphs, but basically what it shows is that the daughters do exactly what mom is doing. They copy exactly her technique. The sons, they develop their own techniques. And this is also true for example, the selection of food. We know that, for example, from a study of orangutans, that the daughters, they eat exactly the diet that their mother is eating. The sons, because they watch adult males also who come through, they learn other foods that they eat. And so they have a more diverse diet than their mom has. So I call that self-socialization, is that they learn, they have a tendency to learn from same-sex models. They look for adults of their own sex and they copy their behavior. And that may include other behaviors as well. And so self-socialization is to emulate models of the gender that you identify with. And this makes, and I think it may be even more important than socialization. We always think that socialization is a one-way street where the adults teach the kids how to behave. But I think there's a lot of self-socialization going on. And maybe more important, and so that makes that individuals learn how to behave like the adults of their sex. And it may also apply to transgender children. So here you have Joan Rofgarden, who is a biologist and is a transgender biologist. And she has developed this idea that transgender identity is the acceptance of a tutor of the opposite sex. Is that children who are transgender, they start to imitate models of the opposite of their biological sex. And that's how they socialize themselves. And so it's a very interesting concept, and I think it explains a lot of what's happening in terms of socialization. And it may apply to the other primates as well. Now, just to give an example in that regard, There's a female named Donna that we had in our colony, who I call her gender non-conforming, in the sense that she, from a very young age, she was attracted to males, and she hung out with males, and she wanted to wrestle with males. And then she grew up to be very male-like. She has the posture and the long hair. Male chimpanzees have longer hair than females. She acts like a male. And so she has female genitalia. She is built like a male. She hangs out with the males and associates with them a lot more than other females do. And also when the males become active and start to intimidate the colony, she goes along with all that. She's mostly asexual. She shows very little sexual behavior. She never had children, and she's completely peaceful, and she's very well integrated in the society. So you have that kind of individuals, and I'm very interested in these individuals. We don't study them enough, I think. We also have males who don't play the macho game. We have sometimes in a group of primates, you have a big male who you would think could be alpha male, but he's not interested in that kind of position. He doesn't do that, and he stays out of confrontations. And so he doesn't play the sort of political games that the males typically play. And so you have individuals who don't show the typical behavior of their sex. I cannot ask Donna, of course, what her gender identity is, but it's very well possible that she would, in human terms, she would be transgender, in the sense that she would say, I feel more like that I'm like a male than like a female. And so it's interesting to have that diversity. And what I want to say about the diversity also is that until now, because it's not systematically studied, but I think there's many examples that it exists. Until now, I've never heard that it's not tolerated. So that's an interesting part of primate society, is they don't have trouble with it. They don't make a fuss about it. This is just how Donna is, and everyone knows how she is, and everyone deals with it. So there is not this level of intolerance that you sometimes see in human society. So to say something about the two species, chimpanzees and bonobos, and how they compare, because not everyone is familiar with the bonobo. Let me say how they compare. So chimpanzees, the males, are very much into dominance. That's the whole business. The whole day is to see who's going to be dominant over whom. This is a high-ranking male who's walking bipedally, has his hair up, and is intimidating another male. But he's actually, the two males are actually the same size. And so that's something that male chimpanzees do all the time. I'm going to show you a little video here. You see a female chimp on the left who is pant grunting, which is a submissive vocalization, to a male who approaches. So you see how the male makes himself look big and puts his hair up and stands upright. It's called the bipedal swagger. That's the way males intimidate others. It's very well known in human society as well as a position. So we recognize this kind of intimidation behavior. And in this case, what I find so intriguing is the two old guys on the side. That's so chimpanzee-like. In chimpanzees also, the older males who cannot be alpha male anymore, they have an enormous amount of power behind the scenes very often. And so they're sometimes more powerful than the alpha male himself. So that's typical primate behavior right there. So here you have an example of it. You have a 17-year-old alpha male. This is the alpha male of the group, 17. He's grooming his buddy, who's twice as old. And this male has made him the alpha male. So who has the most power? That's hard to determine. And I will talk about the distinction between dominance and power. So this one is dominant, but who has the most power of the two? And the third male here is physically stronger than either one of them. We know that in captivity you can test that out. He's physically stronger than they are, but he's kept under control by the coalition. So that's a typical chimpanzee situation. And chimpanzee males are very much into politics the whole day. They are also very territorial. So here you have male chimpanzees patrolling the border in silence usually, and they're waiting to catch someone from the other group, and they may kill them It's very brutal, very aggressive. And so territoriality is very highly developed. And it's much more developed in the chimpanzee than the bonobo. Recently, a study came out on 152 cases of lethal aggression in the forest by bonobos and chimpanzees. 152 cases. 151 of these cases were chimpanzees. There was only one case with bonobos, and there was a suspected case, was not even observed, and was not sure. And so that's how big the difference is between chimpanzees and bonobos. A chimpanzee is a very territorial animal. This is a bonobo. Bonobos also have a very high voice, a childlike voice. So they're a bit smaller than chimpanzees, and they have this childlike voice, and they have a lot of sexual behavior. They also have longer legs than the chimpanzee. And so even though genetically they're equally close to us as the chimp, anatomically I would say the bonobo is more human-like, looks more like Australopithecus. And because of these long legs, this is a male on the right and a female on the left. And the size difference is not so great in the bonobo. So that's the situation with them. And as I said, they have sex in all sorts of positions. They're sometimes very creative, like this one here. And they also have sex in all combinations. So I usually call them bisexual, in the sense that I'm not sure that they have a preference for one gender over the other when they have sexual relations. So the bonobo is a very sexual character. And female-to-female sex is very important to them, because the females collectively dominate the males. It's not an individual dominance. The easiest way to get sex among bonobos is to give them food. And that's because food induces competition, as it does in all animals. Food introduces competition, and their way of dealing with competition is to have sex with each other. So here you have a typical situation at the sanctuary where we do our work. The bonobos are waiting for their food. Here they're waiting around. And now the food has arrived and they have sex. So they're multitasking at this point. And that's how bonobos deal with the potential competition. There is actually very little violence and very little fighting over food. They're really sort of, we call them the primate hippies, they're sort of hippies. Now this is Claudine André on the right, who's the founder of the only sanctuary that exists in the world for bonobos, which are bonobos who are saved from the bushmeat hunting. And then they are raised by humans, and then she introduces them back to the wild. It's a very successful program. It's very rare that people succeed at that, but she succeeds. And she's sitting here next to Mimi, Princess Mimi, who is the first alpha female that she had in her group. So in bonobos, bonobo groups, all the bonobo groups in captivity that I know, I think I know all the bonobos in the world, there's only 120 of them, they're all led by a female. I've never heard otherwise. And in the wild also, there's not so many studies, but in the wild also, the highest ranking individuals are females. And it's a collective dominance. The female on her own cannot dominate a male because the males are bigger. But the females together dominate the males. And so each alpha female, like Mimi, she has a clique of high ranking females around her, and that clique of four or five females, they dominate the whole thing. So that's a typical situation. And another thing about bonobos is that they are not territorial. So they're totally different from chimps in that regard. The females like to come together with females of other groups. And so here you have the gathering of females from three different groups in the wild who have come together. They share food. They sometimes even adopt orphans from the other group. And so there's a lot of contact between the females. The males tend to, initially, when these groups meet, to be a little bit aggressive. But the females, they like to mingle with others. So that's a total difference with the chimpanzee. So now something totally different. Something about the toys and the play behavior of males and females. And I know it's important because in our current society, we discuss quite a bit of play behavior and should we give dolls to boys and trucks to girls and things like that. Maybe we should. I don't have an opinion about that. But in the primates, there's very clearly a distinction: is that the young females are very fond of infants, and they play with dolls. And so humans, of course, the doll is the oldest. For archaeologists, it's the oldest toy that we know of the human species, and can be made out of almost anything. And in the primates, we see a very similar tendency. So if you give dolls to apes, like here Coco the gorilla, or a chimpanzee in a sanctuary, if you give them dolls, the females will hold it against their nipple as if they're nursing. They will put it on their back, carrying, putting on their belly, carrying. They may build a nest for them. They drag them around the whole day. If you give these dolls to young males, they don't last very long. Because the males take them apart, they want to see what's inside, and there's more like a curiosity about them than that they wanted to take care of them. And we know now from studies in the field, which you might say this is a typical human situation, human influence. We know from studies in the field that chimpanzees pick up rocks and logs, wooden logs, and it's mostly females who will carry them around and hold them like an infant and build nests for them. And so they make dolls out of objects that they find in the forest. And so there's a very strong tendency to do this, and I think it's related to their enormous tendency to be interested in infants, which is also universal in the primates, that the females have that more than the males. So here you have a typical study. This is a macaque study, macaque monkeys. How often they handle infants. Now, in the adults, you see that the females handle infants far more than the males, which is logical, because these are the mothers of these infants. And of course, they are handling the infants more than the males do. But now, if you look at the younger ones, these are subadult females who don't have offspring yet, and juvenile females. It's again the females doing far more of it than the males, are basically not interested in infants. And if, for example, in a group of monkeys there's a newborn, the mother arrives with a newborn baby, she's going to be surrounded by a mass of young females, not young males. The males are not interested. The young females will surround her, and they want to touch the baby and smell it and hold it. And if they get older, they can become the babysitters. So if they're older and more experienced, then the mothers will let them hold the baby and carry it away and take care of it.
Mothers set up a baby and toddler group in a quiet part of the temple. But looking after baby is a full-time occupation. So once they are 3 weeks old, if mom wants a break, she has a solution. Employ a teenage babysitter. As these young females develop feelings of love and care, they just want to hold a baby. It's an arrangement that gives the moms a break, a chance to be pampered and groomed.
So in the chimpanzee, mothers don't let young females walk away with their baby. So here's a young female who has kidnapped a younger sibling, a baby, from her mom. She's walking away with it at a zoo. But here you see, this is her younger sister, and this is her mom, who's following. So she doesn't let her walk off like that. And it's only if, after many days and maybe many years, she has proven that she's good at this, that the mother will let her really be a babysitter. So the apes are a bit more careful with these things. But still, there's an enormous tendency in the young females to hold babies, carry babies, and learn maternal behavior. Now, we often speak of maternal behavior as an instinct, like the maternal instinct. I think that's nonsense. The maternal behavior is very, very complex, and there's an enormous amount of learning that goes into it. We know that now even for rodents. There's rodent studies on how young females learn how to care for babies. And certainly in the primates, it's a very complex task, and they need to learn from others. And if they don't, then they cannot raise offspring. So for example, if you have a zoo where they have gorillas and they have never had a baby before, and so one of the females gets pregnant, they have a problem. Because they know if that female gets a baby, it will go wrong. And so what zoos often do is they invite human mothers, humans who have a newborn, to sit in front of the gorilla enclosure and nurse their baby. And she will do that every day, and the gorilla females will watch very closely so that when their baby is born, they have at least learned something about that process. So there is a learning component to maternal behavior that's extremely important because it's one of the most complex things that they can do. And we underestimate that if we say they have a maternal instinct. Maternal instinct is the attraction to infants. Yeah, that's clearly there and that's clearly present in the young females, but attraction is not enough. You need to know what to do. Now, what do young males do in all that time that the females hang out with babies? The young males, they wrestle. They love to wrestle. Here you have a young male who wrestles with an adolescent, testing his strengths on him. That's the sort of thing that they do the whole day. And this too is, of course, a preparation for adult life, in the same way that the young females with these dolls and babies prepare for adult life, the young males are preparing. And we know from all the primate studies that young males, it's called rough and tumble play, young males do far more of it than young females. And in all the studies of universal studies in humans, we know that boys do this more than girls. And so the wrestling tendency is very strongly developed in young males. So at a very early age, we see already some real big differences in behavior. I want to say a few things about mental abilities because traditionally the inequality in society has been explained by saying that men are smarter or more intellectual than women. This is Darwin. I'm a big fan of Darwin, but even Darwin said this. There seems to me to be great difficulty from the laws of inheritance in women becoming the intellectual equals of men. And we now know from studies in psychology that now that boys and girls have a much more similar education than they used to, that many of these intellectual differences actually don't exist. And I've worked all my life with primate intelligence, or the intelligence of animals in general, and there's really not much evidence. I don't think there are studies that indicate major differences in intelligence between males and females. The intelligence of the two sexes have clearly evolved in tandem. But I do want to, just for fun, show you some examples of very smart animal behavior of both males and females. This is Ayumu, a young male who astonished the world by being better at a task than humans. So this is a task where he needs to press these numbers in the right order, but the numbers disappear within 200 milliseconds. So he barely gets to see them. You will see how this goes. They disappear right away. You can try this at home if you want. I believe now he's going to make an error. You hear a different sound. When he makes an error, he makes a different sound. So a human was so good at this, and then he was tested against, in Kyoto. He was tested against Japanese students, and he did better than the students. And then some American psychologists, they got very upset by that, and they wrote a paper where they showed that they themselves could do this task after some training, but with five numbers. Now, five is not the same as nine. And in addition, Ayumu is now training on 15. They will never catch up with Ayumu, but they just couldn't stand that he was so good at this. Here we have Lizala, a female bonobo, who picks up a very heavy rock and starts a walk with it. So this is about planning capacities, which we study more and more now in the primates and in the birds, thinking ahead. So she picks up the rock, and then she starts to walk. You're not going to see the whole video, but she's going to walk for 1 kilometer with it, meaning that she's going to walk for 15 minutes with the rock. And here she picks up some objects, and she drops the rock. And then she picks it up again. And then she goes to the only hard surface that exists in this whole sanctuary. And what she has picked up in the meantime are nuts. And she uses the rock to crack the nuts. So if you think about it, what that means is that she picked up her tool 15 minutes before she even had the nuts in her hand, probably knowing where she could find those nuts. And then found them and then brought them to the big stone where she cracks them. And so that's planning, and we have increasing evidence of planning capacities in animals, that they think ahead. And again, I don't think there's a difference between males and females in this regard. Here you have a young male. We have hung some bananas very high, and we have given them sticks and boxes. And he immediately knows that he needs to use both. He also knows that he has not been trained. This is just spontaneous behavior. He also puts the box always in the upright position. Now he gets one. This is the alpha male. The alpha male has a different strategy. And then in the same group of chimps, we had females who brought down a drone. And the females, this is also planning. They were used to birds, of course. They don't mind the birds. But the drone, they hated. There was a drone flying around. And so they picked up sticks and they waited in a tree for the drone to come by. So that is some of the work that we do on intelligence of animals. And again, there's no indication that the sexes differ much in that regard. In humans, of course, there are now studies on boys and girls in school systems where they get very similar education. And there's very little difference. Certainly in general intelligence, there's almost no difference. And sometimes there is a difference in some subcategories of cognition, like let's say spatial orientation or early vocabulary. So sometimes there are sex differences there, but most of the time there is really nothing. So the males, the alpha males, people often think that alpha males must be monsters. And this comes partly from an early study of 100 years ago that was very much popularized. There was a study on Hamadryas baboons, and in Hamadryas baboons, the male is twice the size of females and has enormous canine teeth. And the males can be violent in that species and certainly dominant over the females. But the study was done at a zoo where they put them together, these monkeys, in the wrong ratio. So when they put monkeys together who didn't know each other, they put, 100 males with 5 females. Well, this was a disaster, and they killed each other. And Zuckerman wrote about it as if that was the normal behavior of primates, is that males are violent and they always fight over females. And that became the story that everyone knows. Very simplistic view, and not even correct for baboons, because we know that baboons in the wild don't have that kind of bloodbath that he was describing, but it was a very unfortunate beginning in primatology. Now, I've known many alpha males in chimpanzees and bonobos who are real leaders. They have leadership capacities. Like here you have an alpha male chimpanzee who stops a fight between two females, a female on the left, female on the right. He stands between them, and he stops a fight between them. Here you see a little video of it.
Where there's a fight, Nicky intervenes. That's part of his job as leader. Jonas is fighting Walter. But Jerome, the second man, is on his way. Here he comes. He chastises Walter.
So that's something that the males do. That's the control role, as we call it. They break up fights. They keep order. They come up for the underdog. So they will defend juveniles against adults and females against males. And if a male is good at that, at the control role, he becomes a beacon of hope for the weak in society, because he's the one who protects them, and he creates an enormous amount of safety. And that kind of males can become extremely popular. So they are alpha males, but they're extremely popular. Males also have a protective role. So here you have a typical situation with chimpanzees crossing a road in a village, and the alpha male is going to stand guard. Gorilla males do that also. Gorilla males are even more impressive. They stand in the middle of the road like a policeman. So he's going to stand here, wait till everyone crosses over. So they have a protective role, they keep order, and a good alpha male creates an enormous amount of security and unity in a group. And that's why they can become extremely popular in a group. And so when they then are challenged by other males, the whole group will defend them. They want to keep that alpha male. And if a bully, we also sometimes have males who are bullies, if a bully is challenged, the others are not eager to defend him. And they help the challenger usually, and so that's how they get rid of a male like that. So that's the situation. And so this whole idea that we have of high-ranking males being terrorizing the group, I think is incorrect, and people need to start think differently about it. The last thing I want to say is something about potentials. Potentials are behavior that we see in the sexes that you don't always get to see, but that they are capable of. And it's very important. It's very important for a discussion about if you want to change the gender roles in human society. It's important what the potentials are. What are they capable of doing? And so, for example, leadership capacities. Of course, for the bonobos, this is obvious because in bonobos, the alpha individual is a female. But even in chimpanzees, where the alpha individuals are usually males, you have an alpha female, of course, the highest ranking female. This is Mama, the female that I wrote my previous book about. And Mama was a very important character. She was alpha female for 40 years. So she saw a lot of alpha males come and go. And she had more power than most of the males. So you always need to make the distinction between who's physically dominant and who has the power. So, for example, Mama, there was no male who could become an alpha male without the support of Mama. If she didn't support a male, there was no way he would rise to the top. And so then you have to question who's the most powerful. And so females can have an enormous amount of power in a primate society, even in one that is dominated by males. So I think that's an important distinction to make. Recently, there was an article in the New York Times about a macaque group. Typically, they are led by a male, but in this case, they have an alpha female. And for more than a year, I believe, I don't know if they say that, but for more than a year, she was the alpha female. And so these things happen, that potential exists. And so leadership capacities, because people sometimes say it's natural for males to be dominant and males are better leaders, I'm not convinced. And also after the COVID crisis, we've had some male leaders here and there who have not done very well, I think. And we have had some female leaders who have done a lot better with the COVID crisis. So I'm not convinced at all that males make better leaders than they make different leaders. It's maybe different. We can discuss that, but not necessarily better, I think. So something that a mama would do, typical behavior of a high-ranking female, is that she would fix relationships after a conflict. So whereas the males would stop a conflict and step in, this is after a fight between two adult males who are not reconciling at this point, they're sitting opposite, not looking at each other, then Mama will come over, typically, and she will sometimes even pull at the male to make him follow and sit next to the other one. She will bring them together, and when they groom each other, she will walk off, she will not stay there. So that's typical behavior of high-ranking females. Another potential that is important is male nurturance. And I need to mention that because recently some conservatives have made fun of paternity leave. It's already bad enough that the U.S. doesn't have maternity leaves officially. Like I'm from a country where I think you have 6 months or 8 months of maternity leave. But they're making fun of paternity leave, as if men certainly don't need to take care of children. That would be ridiculous. But, you know, males have an enormous capacity for caring for offspring. And even in species like the chimpanzee, where males normally don't do that. Males are normally not much involved with the young. It may happen, and it happens when there are orphans around. So here you have a group in Uganda, chimpanzees, which had a lot of respiratory disease, and many adults died as a result of our many orphans. And that's where males may adopt them. This is an older brother. So there were several of these couples of older brothers adopting. This is a 17-year-old male adopting a 7-year-old youngster. And so they adopt them, and sometimes for years. They stay with them for years. One of the most famous cases was an alpha male in a different forest who adopted a very young orphan who had lost its mother and took care of it, I believe, for 5 years. And so it's not just that they hang out with the kid. They carry them, they feed with them, they protect them, and so they act like a mother almost.
Freddie took to parenting very naturally. He patiently taught Oscar the skills of the forest, things he should have learned from his own mother. With a new parent like Freddie, Oscar blossomed.
Every day was like a voyage of discovery about what we would see next. And the relationship just became more and more special as we became much more familiar with those two characters.
So it's important that these males have the potential to take care of children. In humans, I would say it's even more than just a potential, because humans, we are different because we evolved nuclear families where males and females take care of offspring together. So I think our species has even more of that potential. And so the idea that males are not capable of taking care of the young is nonsense, because even this alpha male who has other business, you know, he has to take care of his position also among the males. So he has other business to do. He's capable of doing this. And so that capacity exists. So I think potentials are very important to understand the possibilities of gender relationships. And so I want to close with saying that, yes, I've explained what gender and sex are, and they are different things, and it's very useful to have the concept of gender so that we can talk about the cultural influences and the flexibilities that exist. But I think they also always remain connected. There are people who want to disconnect them and say gender is something totally different, it's purely cultural. I don't think there are things that are purely culture or purely nature. I don't believe in that kind of purist language. I think it's always an interaction between two. I think all hominids, so humans and apes, they have genders, because gender relates to cultural transmission, and we know that exists in other species, and so I don't think it's a concept that is limited to our species. There are behavioral sex differences. One of the most important one is violence. You look at all human societies, the homicide statistics. You look at all primate societies. Physical violence is more typical of males and females. Another one is empathy. There are empathy differences between the sexes. Other ones that I've already mentioned is that young males like to wrestle. Young females like to hold dolls or infants. And so there are behavioral sex differences that do exist and that are so general that biology must be involved in them. And then there are behavioral potentials that we don't always get to see, or that are harder to see, so to speak, that blur the sex differences. And it's important to know about those. And I thank you for your attention.
I really appreciate your work on the animal foundations of empathy and reciprocity and so forth, but I'm also always very interested in where the changes happen with human beings. And one of the things I've seen turn up in some of the literature, and I'd like your response on this, is issues of early women having solidarity to bring the males into the process of feeding the offspring. And that one of the things involved in this is the synchronization of menstruation. Now, I'm wondering, Have you seen that theory? How does that play out with, say, bonobos and other chimps?
Synchronization of menstruation. Well, it is claimed, it has been claimed for rats, for example. It has been claimed for women in nunneries and things like that. It has been claimed for female students in dormitories. But the evidence is actually very slim. So the statisticians who have looked at that, they have serious doubts about it. I'm sure it happens that two women menstruate the same day for a couple of months, and they will think this is a synchronization, but it may be accidental. So the statisticians who have looked into it, they are not convinced that it's an existing phenomenon. I'm willing to believe it, that it exists, but I don't think... Huh? I'm not sure that it exists there. It's going to be very tough, you know, because menstruation occurs when you're ovulating, and of course in many primates, for example in chimpanzees have an interbirth interval of 6 years, 5-6 years, meaning that a female doesn't ovulate for 5 or 6 years because she's nursing and she's pregnant and all of that. Then all of a sudden she starts to ovulate, and she ovulates maybe for 3 cycles. They have a 35-day cycle like humans. So she ovulates for 3 cycles, and then she's pregnant again. And then she goes off it again. So for chimpanzees or bonobos, there's not a lot of opportunity for females to synchronize because they have babies. And I think for humans, the same is the case. And so, yes, nunneries or dormitories of students, that's where you might expect it, because these women are not getting pregnant, or at least hopefully not getting pregnant. But the evidence is slim, I must say.
Do bonobo and chimpanzee communities encounter each other, either in the wild or in sanctuaries? And when that happens, do the chimpanzees always win because the bonobo males are, you know, so... less strong, or uh-huh. Or do bonobo females organize a very capable defense?
Yeah, so in the wild they don't have a chance to meet because there's a river between their areas that is the Congo River, which is 2 miles wide. So there's really not much of an opportunity, even though people say that in the past there have been mixings going on, and we have some genetic evidence for that. In captivity. Yes, there are hybrids known. So sex has occurred in captivity between bonobos and chimps, and we have hybrids between them. The only thing I know from people who have seen them interact in captivity, like at zoos, is that the female bonobos try to drive male chimpanzees crazy with their big swellings and sort of teasing them and flirting with them from a distance. And I'm sure if they meet, the male chimpanzees will try to mate with these females. What happens between the males cannot be good for bonobo males, because a chimp male is a lot bigger and stronger. Cannot be good for them.
Hi, I was wondering how we're measuring strength. When you said that Olympic-level female athletes only get as strong as the average untrained male, it's hard for me to imagine like Serena Williams being as strong as some of the guys in this audience. So can you maybe explain how we're measuring strength?
So the study that I was referring to is a hand grip. Hand grip is usually used for upper body strength. So the strength in the hand. So that's limited. It doesn't include the legs, for example. And I think if you're going to look at legs, maybe we get a different picture. That's possible. But the hand grip study compared men and women in Germany, and then included Olympic athlete women. And those women got to the average of the untrained males. That's where they didn't get further than that. But I agree, there's many ways of measuring this. So we did a hand grip study on chimpanzees one time, where we found, interestingly, it had nothing to do with gender, where we found, interestingly enough, that chimpanzee females, they start to lose, their hand grip reduces, hand grip strength reduces after the age of 35. Now they can live up to 60 in captivity, 50 maybe in the wild, but at 35 already it starts to weaken. In human women, it starts to weaken at 60. So until 60, it's still pretty stable. There's maybe not anymore like what it was in 25, but so hand grip is often used as a proxy, but you're right, it's a limited measure.
Thank you very, very much for such an interesting and enlightening talk. I was just wondering, where is the sanctuary where you do your work?
The Bonobo Sanctuary is near Kinshasa. So that's in the DRC, what is it, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And so it's the only sanctuary that exists. They rescue bonobos that are baby bonobos that are victims of the bushmeat hunting, because the poachers, they kill the mothers and sell their mothers as meat, but they don't kill the babies because they think they can get more money for the babies live as pets. And then they're confiscated and brought to the sanctuary. And so it's a sort of very sad situation, that because during the COVID crisis, they had an increase in orphans, an increase in poaching going on, because there was less control in the forest. So these bonobos are then raised by women, local women. So Claudine's philosophy is that each baby bonobo needs one mother, and so she gives them one woman, who is always, every day, and during the COVID crisis, actually, these women stayed at the sanctuary, even though they have families themselves. They stayed at the sanctuary to take for 3 months or 4 months, take care of these baby bonobos. And since they remain dependent for so long, this takes like 4 or 5 years. And then I think at the age of 6 approximately, they take them away from these women and they put them in one of the big enclosures. They have enclosures of 60 acres, huge enclosures. They put them in there, and then these baby bonobos have to fend for themselves in the bonobo group, which is not always easy for them, but they have to do that. And what they have done now twice is take a dozen of these bonobos from the sanctuary and move them to a wild area far away. And they have been successful introducing them, which is remarkable, because most introductions that I hear of are disasters. They go completely wrong because you introduce animals in the wild where they catch diseases, they don't know how to survive. They meet, for example, chimpanzees, they meet hostile individuals who want to kill them. And then the bonobos, since they are not so territorial, it makes it also easier to get them in there. So it's very interesting. Yeah, there's many Congolese who visit because it's open to the Congolese. For you from the West, it's not going to be so easy to get there. But if you want to look it up, it's called Lola Ya Bonobo. L-O-L-A, Lola Ya Bonobo. It means the paradise of bonobos.
Yeah. Kind of as a follow-up to that question, how do you control for the fact that you're studying a population where there's this massive trauma at a young age, and then they're being raised by human women and possibly learning so much about gender and gender roles from humans? So how do you control for that when you're studying these, you know, behavioral differences between different sexed animals, but they're learned so much from human behavior?
Yeah, but we compare, and so in my book I compare also with what we know about the wild situation. So for example, the doll play of the chimpanzees, that was not in the sanctuary. That was in really wild chimpanzees. And yes, they may be influenced by humans, but the humans that they see are all adults. It's not children playing with dolls and things like that. So yeah, there are human influences in the sanctuary, for example, and certainly these sanctuary bonobos, they are traumatized orphans. And so we compare their, for example, their empathy level, because we do studies on empathy, with non-orphan, because there's also bonobos that are born in these sanctuaries, because the females reproduce with the males that are there. And so we also have mother-raised bonobos that we can compare with the orphans. It's a very interesting comparison, because the orphans have less empathy, and that's true for human orphans, too, in the Romanian orphanages, they've looked at that. Human orphans, traumatized orphans, have a lot of trouble with empathy because they have trouble regulating their emotions. And so it's an interesting comparison. But yeah, you always need to keep in mind, if you look at captive studies or wild studies, what is the human influence here? Yeah.
That's a fascinating talk. And this obviously does not apply to humans, and it's maybe a little loaded. But you mentioned that the females perform imitative behavior, and the males tend to try out new things. Would you venture to say that the males are more creative, or that's too loaded?
No. That's a good question, but that's not what I implied. What I implied is that the females copy their moms, and they have a model with them the whole day. That's their mother. The young males, they copy usually adult males that they see around. They don't have a father figure, like they don't have nuclear families, and so who their father is a mystery to them. But there are adult males around, and the young males tend to imitate them. And as a result, their behavior deviates from what the mother is doing and what the daughter is doing. So it's not that the males are more enterprising or more innovative, so to speak, is that they pick different models. I think that's what's happening. So there are studies actually on innovation, because people are interested in innovation. And I'm not sure that there's a sex difference there. I'm not sure we have found sex differences in that regard. Okay? Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.